After the testimony ended, Guidoboni argued for acquittal, claiming that the government had not proven its case. At most, the defense lawyer maintained, prosecutors proved the elements of a lesser charge, a misdemeanor under the statute. The question of a lesser charge had arisen before, and this time the judge appeared to be ready to consider it seriously, but he could not give the jury the option of considering a misdemeanor charge along with the felony unless the defense asked him to. That meant the decision was up to Robert. It was a gamble. It meant weighing the chance of an acquittal against the chance of a compromise verdict. Having a misdemeanor on his record was certainly preferable to a felony. Then again, if the jury didn't have a lesser charge to fall back on, it might choose the harsher conviction. When Munson adjourned the court until the following Monday, the matter was still unresolved. The family had 3 tense days to kill in Syracuse. In search of distraction, having already toured the nearby Corning Glass Factory, everyone went bowling, then to the movies. Robert spent the weekend sleeping late. Since the judge hadn't yet ruled on the prosecution's motion to disallow testimony related to Robert's intent, it was expected that his instructions to the jury would serve as his ruling. He took the weekend to think about it. Both sets of attorneys presented themselves in the judge's chambers first thing Monday morning and heard his decision on intent. To Guidoboni's disappointment, but not to his surprise, the judge had not changed his mind on the irrelevance of Robert's intent to cause damage. As the judge read the law, the question of intent pertained only to whether the defendant intended to break in, not whether he intended to cause damage. At that point, Guidoboni knew the case was over. His closing arguments to the jury were listless, his demeanor smacked of defeat. Prosecutor Ellen Meltzer, on the other hand, made her closing arguments with special vigor. She reminded the jury that they had heard Morris himself admit to the crime, to its deliberate nature, and to causing authorized users to lose use of their computers. "Mr. Morris's computer worm was not a juvenile prank," she intoned. "In no way was it a legitimate Cornell research project gone awry." "Indeed," she said, "there is nothing to thank the defendant for. You do not thank a terrorist for increased airline security awareness, and you do not thank a drunk driver." But before she could finish, Guidoboni was on his feet, outraged by the comparison. The judge agreed. The word terrorist had special meaning in Syracuse. A year earlier, terrorists had blown up a Pan Am jumbo jet over Lockerbie, Scotland. Among the passengers were 35 students returning home from a Syracuse University study abroad program. Certainly in this city of all places, Robert Morris could not be compared to terrorists who claimed innocent lives. The judge sustained Guidoboni's objection. When Judge Munson delivered his instructions to the jury in an implicit ruling on the prosecution's intent motion, he told the panel to disregard the testimony concerning the defendant's intention to cause damage. It was not relevant to the charge. He read the indictment to the jurors and explained the elements of the crime. If, in its deliberations, the panel should conclude that the government had failed to prove each of the elements, then the jury must return with an acquittal. But he said nothing about a lesser charge. Robert had decided to gamble on an acquittal. During jury deliberations, Robert, Janet, Ben, and Meredith started playing cards at the defense table until the guard told them to stop. Robert picked up his historical novel. Bob occupied himself with an old 85-cent Penguin Classic edition of one of Xenophon's histories. Anne mingled with some of the reporters. 5 hours later, the jury filed back into the courtroom and delivered its verdict. Robert watched intently as each juror was polled and each said guilty. Reporters made a dash for the 2 pay telephones in the building. The judge set a date for post-trial motions and adjourned the court. Robert stood up and smiled meekly at Janet. Anne rushed up to the defense table, but Bob hung back, staring straight ahead, the fingers of his left hand rubbing together as if touching an invisible piece of fabric. Anne motioned for him to join the rest of the family, which had formed a huddle at the defense table. Anne wanted to talk to Guidoboni about their options. The Morrises were people accustomed to having the privilege of options, and a felony conviction seemed to be no exception. In the face of something essentially beyond her control, Anne was still considering where to go from here. But Guidoboni held up his hands and said, "Listen, folks, we don't have to go over this right now. There's plenty of time to talk about it." In other circumstances, the computer scientist who worked for an American intelligence agency so hidden that even its name was once secret, and his young son would quietly have lived out their lives as part of the country's best and brightest. Now, the father was caught in the glare of publicity, and the son was a felon. Someone who seemed destined to become one of the country's software stars was facing jail. The lawyer gave Robert an apologetic handshake, snapped at the throng of reporters on his way out of the courthouse, and returned to his hotel. Flanked by family members, Robert left without saying a word. In his son's absence, Bob Morris stood in the plaza in front of the court, drawing reporters into a tight circle around him by responding to their questions in a voice just above a whisper. He said he still believed that his son didn't have a fraudulent or dishonest bone in his body.